All right, folks, let's get started. I picked out another Ode of Solomon for us to pray. That if you, there's a handout which says the fourth book of the Ode of Solomon. Let's pray together Ode 35. The sprinkling of the Lord shaded me with serenity and caused a cloud of peace to rise over my head, so that she might watch me at all times, and she became a salvation for me. Everyone was shaken and frightened. Smoke and judgment rose from them, but I was calm in the order of the Lord. More than shade he was for me, more than foundation. I was like a young one who was carried by its mother, and he gave me milk, the dew of the Lord. Okay, so today I want to do Gospel of Mary and Gospel of John in relationship to a common theme, but is not expressed the same way. So there may be some interesting differences of meaning and similarities, and that's what I would call the journey to God. We'll start with Mary because we're less familiar with it, and then come in with John and make some comparisons and conclusions, perhaps. So the Gospel of Mary, as you may remember from yesterday, its arc is Jesus is talking, and then Jesus gives his last message and he leaves. The disciples start crying. Mary says, "Don't cry. He told me a bunch of things that he didn't tell you." And then they say, "Well, tell us." And then she sort of does, except for the fact that we don't have all that material in the text. And then afterwards, Peter and Andrew, and we'll talk about this tomorrow, challenge Mary and think that she's making it up. Then Levi defends her, and then either only Levi or all of the disciples go out to proclaim what Jesus and Mary have said at the end. It's the message that Mary knows from Jesus that I want to talk about today, and this is called basically a story of the ascent of the soul to God. And this is a very common kind of story in the ancient world. In other words, I could give you 20 books which have a story of the soul ascending to God, and they're all relatively different. In other words, you might call this a motif of ancient literature, a way of beginning to think about what it means to ascend to God, and most people have different meanings that they make of that. So it's not that the ancient world agrees on what happens in the ascent to God. Now, one of the most interesting divisions in the ancient world's ascent to God is that sometimes it happens to you before you die, and sometimes it happens to you after you die. In other words, you can ascend, your soul can ascend to God while you're living. So this is not necessarily for the ancient world an afterlife experience. I would say by and large in the modern and postmodern imagination, it is an afterlife experience, right? If we were talking with almost anyone and said, and the soul ascended to God, they would be thinking that we're talking about not an experience of one of us who are living, but an experience of someone who has died. I gave yesterday just briefly the really interesting example of Paul. And this is, this is so interesting how we selectively read the traditional New Testament. I would wager that not one in 200 people know that Paul says in 2 Corinthians that he ascended to the third heaven. while he was alive. In other words, for Paul, Paul knows about the ascents to God and says, yeah, that happened to me. He doesn't say he stayed there. In other words, he went up to God, and that was an experience of his in his life. Then in the Nag Hammadi version of that, called the Apocalypse of Paul, that extends Paul's story. So the Apocalypse of Paul actually picks up on this little little reference in 1 Corinthians 9 to Paul saying, I ascended to the third heaven. And this other book that was discovered in 1945, it makes a whole story out of Paul's ascents to God. And actually there, in that story, he doesn't go just to the third heaven, but the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh heavens. Often in the ancient world, when there is an ascent to God by the soul, it is not without problems. In other words, one of the things that the ancients are working on as they tell about the ascent of the soul to God is the travails of people's connection to God. What I'm going to suggest today, and again, if we could study the ascent of the soul to God in the Gospel of Mary, the 75 times that we studied 1 Corinthians 3, we'd be in better shape. But we only have about 20 minutes for this part, if we can. And I want to say that it's fairly obvious in the Gospel of Mary that the ascent of the soul is in lived experience, not after death. And that's mainly because of this. By the way, I gave you another translation of the Ascent of the Soul. It's Karen King's translation, just because I wanted you to see another one than the one that's in my book. One of the great things about studying ancient literature is I always tell, for instance, people when we're studying the Bible together, bring different Bibles so you have different translations so that you actually may get back to the Greek. Now, and in case that can't happen here because it's the Coptic, and I didn't bring my really fast Coptic book with me. So we've got a slightly different translation here. And what you'll see here is as the soul ascends to God, it's challenged by powers. And the text is broken in chapters 8 and 9, as you'll see here. So it looks like the text picks up again in right after the soul has been challenged by the power of darkness. And the soul and the power of darkness, as the soul is going to God, the power of darkness says, hey, wait, stop. You're not allowed to go to God. And so the power of darkness interrogates the soul before it can go on. The second power we have in our text, and that's the power of desire that stops the soul on its way to God. And there, desire interrogates the soul, and there, desire says, here's the challenge of the power of desire to the soul. It says, listen, I didn't see you coming down from God. So how can you go up to God? You basically have to stay down in the material world because I know you didn't come from God. You don't deserve to go back to God. And the soul says, look, you missed it, desire. I had other clothes on. My garment was different and you didn't recognize me. So it's not me that is got a problem. It's you. And so the soul, with joy, goes on to God because it has successfully survived the interrogation of desire. Then a similar thing happens with ignorance. And then a similar, very intense thing happens with anger. And then finally the soul gets through darkness, desire, ignorance, and anger, all of their challenges, and is united with God. So here's what I want, the case I would make, it wouldn't be the first mistake I've made if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that this is so much like our life, not like our death. That is us dealing with darkness, desire, ignorance, and anger. Those are all real life experiences. And I would want to say, the way we deal with darkness, desire, ignorance, and anger has a lot to do with our relationship to God. And frankly, at least in my experience, it's not that anger, for instance, always prevents us from going to God. Sometimes anger helps us to go to God. The same with desire. So it's not that these are all bad negotiations as one goes to God, but they're complex negotiations. So, in other words, the way we negotiate darkness, the way we negotiate desire, the way we negotiate our own ignorance, and the way we negotiate our own anger is part of our path to God. So this is what makes, in other words, this feels like a text that's wanting someone to have a relationship with God, and knows that these issues of anger and desire and ignorance and darkness affect whether we can have one. So you can go through those experiences before your relationship with God is fulfilled. So that's my rationale for this being a this life ascent to God rather than an afterlife ascent to God. But that's all a lot of, that's a big mouthful, so let me stop and let's ask a question or two or have a rebuttal or three about this, about what I just said. Is that, what are some of the thoughts or questions you have? Yes, Hannah.
I just have a kind of a quick question. Is the multi-levels or multi-heavens, is that anywhere else? Because this is like the first time I'm hearing that there's multiple levels of heaven.
It's all over the place.
Okay.
Yeah. But again, it's in Second Corinthians, mm-hmm. in Paul's writing, and it's all over both Christian and non-Christian literature of the time. It's kind of a common way of thinking about, again, I would say, the tenuous and less tenuous relationships to God that we have. In other words, the further up in this metaphor you get, the stronger your relationship is to God. And often, when they're talking about the first, second, and third heavens, for instance, in the Apocalypse, both of Adam and of Paul in the Nag Hammadi collection, when you get to the second heaven, there's some problems. And then so each time you negotiate something and then you go further. So, I mean, well, that's also, of course, really an interesting way. I mean, certainly we know that the metaphor of height and heaven is just that. But it is an interesting way of us negotiating the complexities of being in relationship to God. That is, some of our relationship to God is provisional, and some of it's really secure. And there's, of course, a gradation in our experience in between that. So I think this particular way of thinking about our relationship to God has some advantages over the one of the predominant ones in our society, and that is, you got God or you don't have God. Here you sort of have like a piece of God or something like that. Ruth?
I was struck both yesterday and today by, I study Native American spirituality, mm-hmm. and all this stuff is it's the same as Native American spirituality. And mm-hmm. it just makes the two come together for me much more strongly.
Well, thank you. I'm not really good at the Native American. I wish I was, but that's really helpful.
In Buddhism, there's also kind of realms of
Nirvana.
Yeah. So it's just, I think it's some maybe. This shows up more often than maybe we think.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Yes, Matthias.
Is it also fairly common for there to be multiple levels of hell in?
Well, you know, actually, this era isn't much into hell. For the early Christian literature, doesn't do much with hell. But yes, the later sort of the Milton and Dante stuff, and then the 6th and 7th century starts also having levels of hell, too. But it's interesting that the early Christian stuff doesn't do much sort of speculation or spiritual use of hell at all. I mean, there are some references that, I mean, the term hell probably, well, the term hell doesn't exist in the first and second century. There's Hades and a couple of other terms.
Like Sheol.
Sheol, is there another one? Mm-hmm. Yes.
No, I wonder if you might just talk a little bit about what the soul, like what are we talking about with the soul? Tamara and I have been talking about
it. Tamara and I have a plot for her to ask this question. Good.
I'm on board with this in the way that I think of soul, but I don't know what they're talking about. Soul, so.
And Tamara, you want to jump on any other parts of that question?
That explains it. I mean, she explains it.
Okay.
I think my question is, as far as the soul, when they separate it from the body, that they're almost saying it's infinite.
Yeah.
That it's always been. And that's where I have questions.
So the kind of the 50-cent version of this thing, it's such an important question because soul vocabulary has really been problematic for many people's spiritual life, and often it's a really beautiful metaphor. So I want to give you just a little presentation of the vocabulary of soul in the ancient world. And then you and I were just talking a little bit this afternoon about how the modern world has a really different version of that. At this time, in the ancient world, both in the Christian vocabulary and in the non-Christian vocabulary, you really have probably five categories that are active. And they are soul, spirit, and mind, body, and flesh. In other words, I would call this the sort of the ways you think about what it means to be human. And the ancient world, inside and outside Christianity, uses those five categories, and they argue about what those five categories mean. So it's not as if that they're, we all know what this and this means. We moderns will more or less generally say the soul and the spirit are the same thing. And that's because of something that you and I talked about and I'll get to in a minute for everybody. The ancients, and here's where it's really different in the ancient world. For the ancients, all of these categories are material. So, for instance, you'll find in the discovery or the discussions of these, most people say soul is material, but it's thinner than spirit. But there are a bunch of arguments about how thin spirit and soul are, and sometimes you reverse. Sometimes spirit is thinner. In other words, so for instance, If I was right close to you, you would feel. And the word for spirit is the same word for breath in Greek, Coptic, and Hebrew. So in other words,
is it ruach?
Yeah, ruach. So if you know that's, if you call that breath, but you also call that spirit, you know that there is a materiality about spirit. But you notice and you think with the fact that it's thinner than your hand or something like that. So in other words, spirit and soul are complexly, for the ancients, that part of us that is material but less obvious. The mind is in there too, but often the mind is thought of as a portion of the soul or the spirit. So for instance, you may notice here at the top of the page, Jesus makes a distinction for Mary. And there, it's the mind is a part of the soul, which is directing the soul as to where to go. Now, because we're not doing, tomorrow we have to do this for you. So then body is another category of thinking about who we are as humans, as is flesh. And there's a really interesting, funny thing there in that both of those are more weighty, you know, in the lightness of the spirit. And so there's a kind of a governing metaphor of what's light and what's heavy. And so one of the problems with the body and the flesh is that it's heavy. And therefore, this is just for the ancients. I'm not wanting us to necessarily think like this. I'm just trying to clarify the vocabulary here. Therefore, you know, the ancients, like we can see solid things decay. We know that that's one of the things that happens to almost all solid things, is they decay. Therefore, when you talk about yourself as a body or flesh, you have to know that when you're talking about that kind of you, you're subject to decay. And it's interesting, the ancients are kind of scared of decaying, as we are. But they also are usually subtle enough to say, well, that may not be all bad. Often flesh is a little weightier than body. And body, here's the really cool thing about body in the ancients, is this is a body too. Us two. Mm-hmm. Us four are a body. All of us are a body. So body, when we can talk about us as a body, I mean, that's kind of like today, but the ancients really like to talk both about individuals and collectives as bodies. All right, so I'm cramming a lot of things in here, but that's kind of the territory. And clearly here, it's the dominant vocabulary in the Gospel of Mary is mind and soul. And I would say the metaphor of lightness is governing here. In other words, that fits thinking about who we are with God with the metaphor of ascent, right? Because if we're lighter, we got a better chance of getting higher. So just on a literary level, I want to say this is not like some cosmic sureness so much as a poem to help us think with about who we are. And the ancients know this about their vocabulary.
So it sounds like you're saying that they simultaneously think of all these different parts of ourselves as material.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, it's all kind of just a big metaphor. Like, those two things are kind of coexisting, that it's really just a metaphor for thinking about ourselves, but at the same time, the way we think about those aspects is that they're all material aspects.
Absolutely, Karen. I would just change one word, and that's the word just. In other words, this is serious thinking in metaphorical terms. Or I would say, probably for them and for us, when we try to figure out who we are, especially in relationship to God, the best language may be metaphor. So it's not, as far as I'm concerned, it's not that, oh, that's not getting down to business. This is like the way to get to most serious talk about who we are and who God is. And of course that is lovely in the Bible as well. For instance, when we talk about our relationship with one another, many times it's the complexities and power and gentleness and evocativeness of our relationship with one another finally is best expressed in a series of metaphors. And I think I would say our accountability to one another sometimes works best when we take seriously kind of building up of metaphoric vocabulary. Okay, so in other words, for the Gospel of Mary, one of the things is that finally we are with God before we die. Now, are we God? I don't quite think so. It feels like there's some distinction between us, but we're with God. This is, of course, very close to the Matthew, Mark, and Luke vocabulary about the kingdom of God. The realm of God for Matthew, Mark, and Luke is constantly in these parables about real life experience. So the realm of God is, as we said yesterday in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's right among us. It's within us. So notice that it seems like an immediacy of a relationship, a really strong relationship with God, is one of the things that's got the early Christians going. An accessibility, a reality of a real relationship with God. So either the metaphor of the realm of God is among you, now that's kind of scary and exciting, or us ascending to be with God while we're still alive. So I want to do this in Gospel of John terms just a little bit too, and so we can compare and contrast and see how much we like it, either one or both. So, as we alluded to on Monday, the Gospel of John is just so much about Jesus talking about how great he is and how close he is to God the Father. So it's the Father and the Son, the intimacy of that parental child relationship. And as I suggested on Monday, I think this is actually not Father and little boy, this is adult son and adult father, because the ancient world know those are the two people in control of most everything and their intimacy. And again, this is kind of spooky in terms of the way we think of ourselves gender-wise, but in the ancient world, one of the closest intimacies you can get are the father and the son in charge of their world, the adult father and the adult son in charge of their world. Apologies to all of us who would like some other people to be in on that intimacy of power. But Jesus goes on and on. I'm in the Father, and the Father is in me. He says that almost on every page. And as Anders was saying last night, it's and I have a it's so kind of like a web. He's saying that so much all of the time. For me, the fact that that gets repeated in different ways and different valences throughout most of the Gospel of John is sort of like a jazz quartet for me. So, okay, now you, that instrument, take the same theme and play it a little bit differently. Or actually, symphonies do the same, don't they? So this has often made Christian doctrine say, wow, look at how close Jesus is to God, therefore how far away from God we are. So, and this, by the way, the Gospel of John doesn't say this at all. And we'll get that in a minute. But a lot of our own piety and theology does say Jesus and God's closeness as Son and Father is an illustration of how lost or miserable we are. So then, and so it's interesting how we in Christianity, by and large, have been able to appropriate the closeness of Jesus with God in John, but notice that every other time that Jesus says that, he says, as I am in the Father, so you are in me. Let me read what Anders read last night from chapter 17. As you, Father, are in me, and I am in you, so that they may be in us, and that the world may trust that it was you who sent me. So, in other words, the closeness of Jesus, of the Son and the Father, is an exact parallel to the closeness of humans with Jesus, so that it becomes humans' closeness with the us of God. So it's the us of God that we see in Jesus and the Father that is where we belong. And the Gospel of John uses the preposition in to capture this. So we are in Jesus, and Jesus is in the Father. Or another example is chapter 15. I am living, and you will be living. At that time, you will recognize that I am in the Father, and you in me, and I in you. So again, here, it's completely the opposite of a lot of our theological God talk, where the closeness of the Son and the Father make us far away. Here, it's the closeness of the Son and the Father that make us participatory in God. And Becky, what you said last night was really helpful to me, and I just want to have us hold up that. So this thing that happens when we notice we're so close to God that we're practically God. This metaphor of this picture of humanity and God actually has a little play in it. In other words, it keeps us away from claiming divine prerogative too much, I think, by the intermediary character of Jesus. Now, by this I don't mean what Christian doctrine wants to explain, because this is not in John, that, you know, Jesus gets us to God because Jesus died. There's not a sentence that's even close to that in the Gospel of John. But here, it's our being close to Jesus that makes us close to God, not because we were unworthy. It's simply because he and we are so much alike and have this, and that makes us, gives us a participation in the divine. All right, that also is a mouthful. and sort of counterintuitive to kind of the way we read the Gospel of John sometimes. So I want to just say, the Gospel of John seems to me to be an intimacy between the human and the divine. And through the event of Jesus. Thoughts, protests, queries.
Did that transformation in Jesus take place when he was baptized, when he was open to that, when was there a virgin birth? Like,
yeah, that's a great question. It's because John wants us to ask this question, and John's answer is amazing. And it actually, the answer is in the theme for this summer here at Holden. From before the world was made, you loved me. So in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. So the intimacy, our intimacy is founded, our intimacy with God is founded before anything else. And therefore, you don't need any magic tricks or special miracles or special pleading or special bargains. For John, the intimacy between this three metaphors, intimacy between humans and God, is simply basic to the structure of the cosmos. Again, the other stories we tell have these other kind of things that need to show us something like this. But John is way more enthusiastic about the divinity of Jesus and the divine participation of the human and God than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And some people like Matthew, Mark, and Luke better. I was just talking to somebody earlier this afternoon where they said, yeah, that kind of grounded human in Mark is what's really great. But John is just off the charts in saying there's no qualification about that intimacy.
So what would John say to the evangelicals who use John 3:16 sort of as a formula to get to God?
Well, you know, I'm just not into bashing fundamentalists.
No, I'm not either.
John would congratulate them on using that and encourage them to read more. Mm. I mean, I think evangelicals claim an intimacy to God in many ways more deep and lush and get the sensuality of relating to God a lot more than some of us heady liberals.
But at the same time, I get the sense that, like, what you're saying, you know, about this sort of given intimacy, this, like, fact that it's, like, from before you were, the world was created, and it's just there, and you're already in it, and I get the sense that a lot of people who consider themselves Christians would be really threatened.
Yeah, I didn't really do Linda's question justice.
So I mean, I'm just curious because I was kind of along the lines. Yeah,
no, that's
like, well, how do
that.
We,
I should do better.
How do we get around the fact that this would bother people? These ideas probably bother some people a lot.
Okay, so let me take what you both say seriously, and that's really important. Well, what I'm tending to say. Well, what I like to do in my discussions with folks like that is, hey, let's sit down and read this Bible together.
I mean, obviously different people can read it and get different things
out of it.
Go different ways.
And on the other hand, what if we read and found some things that they hadn't noticed? And what if we read and found some things we didn't notice?
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to just join Hal. Because I actually like your answer, but I would be more, I'd pinpoint a little bit, and I'd say, do you have the verse after John 3:16 memorized too? Because the verse following it says, for Jesus came into the world not to condemn it, but to save it. and that so often people want to use that saying as a tool for condemnation. If you don't do this, you're going to be condemned, and that they've misunderstood what John was trying to say, even just in a little snippet of text. And as we know, if you just read in verses, you're missing the big picture. And especially when Jesus is going on and on and on and on and on and on, just grabbing a little snippet of a piece of text is really dangerous, because you're missing the kind of the jazz. You know, jazz, you have to sit for 15 minutes to really feel the rhythm of the music. And if you're just there to hear a note, you're gonna miss the jazzy moment. You know? One thing I wanted to say was that the very beginning of Gospel of Mary, where she says all, or where she, where the gospel says all natures, all forms, all creatures exist in and with one another, and that they will be resolved again into their own roots, for the nature of matter exists into the roots. It's almost like, oh, this John thing isn't just on John, the community, but this was something that people were really experiencing in early, as Christianity was kind of having its birth, that people are really finding this. And I think even though it's not in the canon, there's something very powerful about finding that other people were joining in this way of experiencing divinity. Mm-hmm.
And thank you so much for that, because so this, of course, is, I think, a larger experience I've had in the last 10 to 15 years, is often for the forest and trees deal, we can't see the stuff in our own scripture, and taking this little detour to the new discoveries of ancient Christianity often helps us. So I would say the intimacy between humans and God that's in Mary kind of helps us get a reclaiming in John, and gives legs to some reassessing and some renewal of our relationship to God. Because again, one of the great things I would say about the Bible in general is its multiplicity of metaphor. So, try this about the way, as a way of thinking about your life. And by the way, over here is a story about Jesus, same Jesus, really different kind of image.
I keep going back to the same question in my mind.
Your name?
Bill.
No.
Yeah. Does John mention, is it written in John that we were created, we are created in the image of God? If so, what does John mean by that? Or maybe John doesn't say
John, I don't think that is in John. John does, of course, evoke strongly Genesis 1. And that is in Genesis 1. So John really begins John's own story with a rereading of Genesis 1. So I think the thought isn't far from John, but I don't know of John saying that. That vocabulary in the New Testament occurs most strongly in Colossians. Of the image of God and Christ and humans together. So again, tomorrow, what I'd like to do is then sort of reach back to Monday a bit, and then go, but stay with Mary a little bit more. Most of Monday we were with John. I want to then look at this relationship between men and women in the Gospel of Mary, given the larger kind of spirituality that we're coming to in this. And then I'm going to talk probably for 10 minutes or so in what I call a mini lecture, of just sort of trying to bring us up to date on what scholars of the last 40 years have been thinking about how men and women related to each other in early Christianity. Because that's been a very fruitful set of research in the last 40 years because of the importance of feminist questions. And so I want to give us a little review of the overview, and then we'll go right into the Gospel of Mary, which is ending up to be, by the way, in that discussion, more and more important. And then we'll compare some of the notes we had from Monday. Thanks.